Welcome to Humanities Now, the official podcast of the Humanities Center at Texas Tech. We're glad to have you back with us. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Borschuk, Associate Professor in the Department of English and Director of the Humanities Center at Texas Tech. Humanities Now features regular conversations with members of the humanities community here at TTU. With every episode, these varied voices help us realize the center's mission, asking out loud, what does it mean to be human, and demonstrating how we can answer that question from so many different perspectives. Recently, I was browsing through a nearly 60-year-old issue of Texas Tech's student newspaper, the Daily Toreador. You can find digitized issues of the Toreador on the DSpace website housed by TTU Library's Special Collections. Let me say this. To read this publication across the decades offers a fascinating portal into institutional days gone by. For instance, the issue I was perusing from April 30th, 1964, told readers that 10 Texas Tech undergrads would soon be contestants in the Miss Lubbock beauty pageant. In Campus Greek Life, the paper reported that fraternities and sororities were poised to square off in the annual interfraternity sing-song competition at the Municipal Auditorium. On page one, I learned that a scheduled talk by Peter Valdez, National Secretary of the Young Socialist Alliance, had just been squashed by then-University President R.C. Goodwin. Reached for comment, President Goodwin said only, "I regard it not necessary for him to be on our campus." So students weren't able to hear Valdez deliver his lecture, "Is Socialism the Answer to Latin America's Economic Problems?" as part of the Student Union's Spotlight on Latin America Week. As if commenting on the competing campus interests juxtaposed across these stories, an ad for Anderson Brothers Jewelers, a local business here that only just closed in 2022 after nearly a century, asked in its tagline, "Do you ever feel confused about value?" And speaking of value, well, aesthetic value anyway, buried within a Toreador story about the upcoming campus symposium on contemporary music was the news that John Cage and David Tudor, nationally known composer-performers, would be presenting a concert of avant-garde music in the coming week. One of the key organizers for that concert was Lowell Cross, now an internationally recognized composer himself, but then a music student here at TTU. Interested in emerging electronic music and the avant-garde, Cross had seen Cage and Tudor perform in Austin the previous fall. As he saw it, West Texas deserved access to these artists' experimental goings-on, and Cross talked to his mentor, architecture professor Elizabeth Sasser, about hosting these musical experimentalists here at TTU. Let me interrupt myself for a second to say that Texas Tech hosted a number of famous people that year, as I learned through Special Collections digital archives. TV star Michael Landon visited our campus, for example, as did future vice presidential candidate Sergeant Shriver. Anyway, Professor Sasser was enthusiastic about Lowell Cross's concert idea and persuaded Professor Gene Hemley, the head of music, to fund the event. And so, on May 4, 1964, John Cage and David Tudor appeared in the Coronado Room of the Student Union Building here at Texas Tech, where they performed Toshi Ishinagi's Music for Piano No. 4, electronic version, and Cage's own Variations 2 and 3. Here's a snippet of the Ishinagi piece. And here's a taste of the Cage. As Lowell Cross recalled years later, the response to the Tudor and Cage concert here in Lubbock was, to to use his word, uproarious. Here's Cross's recollection. For variations 2 and 3, John Cage had contact microphones attached to practically everything that he planned to use, including an old mechanical typewriter upon which he typed, and with which he made great use of the right margin bell and the return lever. He taped a contact microphone to his throat and drank water, staring at the audience in the most deadpan manner imaginable as the highly amplified sounds of his water swallowing cascaded over the loudspeakers. He clipped a contact microphone to his cigarette holder and smoked. The amplified sounds of his smoking via the cigarette holder were but mere wisps of audio frequency information in comparison to the water swallowing. It was too much for most of the members of the Lubbock audience. They howled, they hooted, they hollered, and they pitched pennies. And if some pennies landed on the table among his performance materials, John Cage carefully moved them aside with a benign, ascetic expression on his face. The trumpet teacher, who was obviously outraged, marched out, went to his studio in the music building nearby, returned with his instrument, and performed an impassioned, raucous rendition of the tune, "Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better." Now, there was definitely one audience member that spring night in Lubbock for whom Cage and Tudor's concert was not too much. In fact, for Jerry Hunt, the person I have in mind, the Lubbock event was aesthetically invigorating. Hunt was a 20-year-old Texas musician, a classical music prodigy on piano, who'd taken a bus from his Dallas home to attend the concert here on the Texas Tech campus. Hunt was keenly attentive to mid-century avant-garde developments, including intermediate work by the Fluxus Group and the emerging genre of electronic music. Meeting Cage after the Lubbock concert, Hunt's interest in artistic exploration was enlivened. As Hunt's former partner, Stephen Housewright, later recalled, Jerry always said this encounter redirected his musical career from classical music to the avant-garde and the chance operations that Cage employed. While Cage was already influential by 1964, Jerry Hunt was in the early stages of a creative career that would provoke and prove memorable across several aesthetic contexts. In the 1960s, he performed several concerts on piano, presenting innovations in contemporary composition for Texas audiences. At the same time, he worked professionally as a cocktail and jazz pianist, sometimes in Dallas strip clubs or burlesque parlors like Jack Ruby's Carousel Club. But Hunt was investigating oral possibility through new technologies as well, building his own synthesizers and programming electronic devices. An early experimenter in the artistic potential of television and video art in the early 1970s, Hunt worked alongside fellow video artist David Dow at the Video Research Center at Southern Methodist University. By the end of that decade, Hunt began to synthesize audio and video more comprehensively by composing what he called interrelated electronic, mechanic, and social sound site interactive transactional systems. In 1979, he founded a record label to document his and others' avant-garde compositions. By the 1980s, Hunt was a regular performer at significant avant-garde venues like the New Music America Festival. Blurring the boundaries between composition, theater, and ritual, he activated his electronic equipment through movement, composing as he stomped across the stage, often waving handheld objects he'd crafted in collaboration with the visual artist David McManaway. Through all these changes, Hunt never relocated to New York or Los Angeles or Paris or Berlin, but remained based in Texas, living in a home he built with Stephen Housewright on farmland his family owned around Canton. His final work, the video piece, How to Kill Yourself Using the Inhalation of Carbon Monoxide Gas, made as Hunt was dying from lung cancer, is both an instructional video and a startling final statement from an artist who, for decades, had refused to be contained by intellectual or aesthetic boundaries. In February, the Humanities Center returned to our year-long value/values programming theme after winter break and remembered Texas Tech's incidental role in the history of the American avant-garde by bringing Jerry Hunt back to Lubbock through the posthumous exhibition Jerry Hunt Transmissions from the Pleroma. This show, which we hosted in collaboration with Brooklyn's Blank Forms Gallery, gave Lubbock audiences representative examples of Hunt's exploration across artistic context, performance, video art, electronic music, sculpture. Hunt's challenging oeuvre allowed us to engage some of our programming theme's central ideas. What values are embedded in our assumptions about art and aesthetics? What value we might find in having those standards challenged? We'll talk more about Jerry Hunt and the value of the avant-garde after a short break. Did you know that you can donate directly to the Humanities Center at Texas Tech? Gifts to our Excellence Fund supplement the generous funding we receive from the President's Office, the Provost's Office, and the Office of the Vice President for Research and Innovation. Your gift supports the free programming we offer, including online seminars, local film showings, art exhibitions, and a wide array of visiting speakers. Donations also help promote faculty research like that featured on today's show, or allow us to support graduate students in the humanities by funding participation in national conferences and seminars. And it helps pay for this show. If you're interested in donating to the Humanities Center at Texas Tech, please visit our website, humanitiescenter.ttu.edu, and click on the big red donate button on the front page. Thank you. As a composer and performer, Jerry Hunt extended a long history of aesthetic confrontation, well represented in the careers of his immediate influences and precursors like Cage and Tudor, but reaching back to the beginning of the 20th century, amid modernism's frequently oppositional stances. Recall, when Marcel Duchamp showed his cubist painting, Nude Descending a Staircase No. 2, at New York's Armory Show in 1913, one local newspaper writer dismissed the piece as looking like an explosion in a shingle factory. Later that year, Igor Stravinsky premiered his ballet The Rite of Spring at Paris's Champs-Élysées Theater, and the audience rioted because they were so shocked by its discordant sound. In 1923, a Time magazine writer processed his confusion over recent works, like James Joyce's novel Ulysses and T.S. Eliot's poem The Wasteland, with this pithy barb: "There is a new kind of literature abroad in the land, whose only obvious fault is that no one can understand it." These examples remind us that suspicion about the avant-garde long precedes Jerry Hunt's creative efforts. Hunt's compadre, John Cage, was a lightning rod for this suspicion, and not just from his 1964 Lubbock audience. His most famous work, 4:33, which instructs performers not to play their instruments for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, and instead encourages the audience to listen to the ambient sounds of the performance setting, is a perennial object of scorn among those skeptical of avant-garde conceptualism. Cage's invitation to practice deep listening and reflect on how any accumulation of sounds might produce music unsettles many because it unmoors its audience from the familiarity of aesthetic categories. Cage's work, like many experimental efforts, frequently invites an accusatory emperor's new clothes response. Often, those who dismiss avant-garde goings-on do so by arguing that experimental work is not pleasurable to experience and that it doesn't stage beauty for us as art should. In the late 1960s, the philosopher Nelson Goodman spoke back to these assumptions, snidely referring to the time-honored tingle immersion theory, in which audiences presume to approach art without any intellectual preconceptions, and instead judge according to the intensity and duration of the resulting tingle. But this line of thinking might also foster the emperor's new clothes dismissal by encouraging audiences to think that experimental art is largely an intellectual game that one gets or one doesn't. Rather, what if we defer to Cage himself, who famously said, "Art is a sort of experimental station in which one tries out living." Jerry Hunt's music, like Cage's, can be startling for those whose listening expectations have been framed by pop or by less dissonant strands of the Western classical tradition. For instance, here's an excerpt from his piano composition, Lattice. Thank you. But even that piece, in its atonality, has some established landing places. Most obviously, in the use of the piano and pianistic technique. What of other Hunt compositions that move further away? Listen, for instance, to this portion of Hunt's Transform Stream Monopole. As the New Yorker writer Alex Ross poses in a 2010 piece on Cage's career, the simplest explanation for the resistance to avant-garde music is that human ears have a cat-like vulnerability to unfamiliar sounds, and that when people feel trapped, as in a concert hall, they panic. In this account, art's operative principle isn't beauty or the immersive tingle that Goodman mocked, but repetition. In my experience, recurring exposure is a useful way into Jerry Hunt's music. Listen to it, then listen to it again, and then listen to it again after that. I assure you its effects become more wondrous with each successive iteration. But remember, Hunt's work also juxtaposed music composition traditionally defined with embodied performance, questioning any facile tendency to see the two as separate practices. Stephen Housewright recalls this in his memoir Partners. He writes, "The theatrical element of Jerry's work, present from the beginning, gradually narrowed in focus. A videotape of his 1982 performance in Dallas records the large movements and gestures he stomped across the space wearing heavy wood and metal boots he had made that characterize earlier work. In subsequent performances, he scaled down his onstage activities, calling the audience's attention to small objects he often held up on sticks. Very frequently, these objects could simultaneously be moving on video monitors. He began traveling with his own lights, a collection of bulbs of various sizes and colors that he mounted on poles and held by hand, often using these individual lights in a dim space to illuminate objects or gestures or even facial expressions." The objects to which Housewright refers in this passage were those created with David McManaway, on display in the exhibition we hosted here in Lubbock in February. Hunt referred to them at one point as lightning rods of attention, and indeed, they're visually striking, colorful, so assorted in their materials as to seem both odd and mundane. These wands weren't mere supplements to performance, but units of aesthetic energy themselves. In the Blank Forms Editions volume that accompanies the transmissions from the Pleroma exhibition, Lawrence Kumpf and Tyler Maxson write about Hunt's boundary blurring between aesthetic modes. They note how even as his work grew to foreground embodied in visual performance, Hunt still called himself a composer. Kumpf and Maxson write, "For Hunt, his late period performances were about managing the multivalent relationships that exist within the frame of a concert space, a role he compared to that of a priest mediating between an audience and an abstraction. In Hunt's case, instead of God, the abstract force was musical convention." Frequently, reviewers and critics summarize the effect of this individualized approach in quasi-religious terms. Reviewing a 1988 Hunt performance in The Village Voice, for instance, Kyle Gann writes, "Abruptly, yet with a dancer's grace, Hunt made patterns with a small flashlight. He hung wind chimes and jingle bells from his arms, stood on a chair and clapped his hands, hit blocks of wood together with the music's primitive beat, illuminated a flower-shaped rattle with a cigarette lighter, waved another rattle with a stick at the audience, holding a little basket under it, stuck a light bulb in a wall socket, and made shadows with a cane. Your first reaction to Jerry Hunt is, he's hilarious and he's nuts. His actions are so purposeful, though. so unremittingly entertaining, and so consistent in their network of unfamiliar symbols that you soon decide that there's more going on than meets the brain. He's constantly presenting something as though we're about to be enlightened, acting out bizarre rituals with matter-of-fact devotion like a Catholic missionary from another planet. Similarly, in a review of a 1983 performance for the New York Times, John Rockwell wrote that Hunt's show resembled that of some highly nervous witch doctor. The result was wearing, but curiously appealing, too. So, do we need to understand Jerry Hunt's work to find it valuable? And isn't part of the pleasure of a visionary like Jerry Hunt his capacity for coaxing us away from tedious explication or confining aesthetic rationales? Helpfully, the artist and composer David Rosenblum meditates on Hunt's work and value in a retrospective essay in the Blank Forms Transmissions volume. As Rosenblum writes, "In all my experiences interacting with Jerry Hunt, in whatever context they may have spontaneously appeared, conversations and performances have always led to questions and ideas one could spend a lifetime fruitfully contemplating. That's true inspiration." Rosenblum recalls Hunt saying himself in an interview before his death, "If you say to me, how is it that your work is more valuable than a man sweeping the streets? I just can't come up with an answer for it." But as Rosenblum suggests, this isn't a dead end or final word on the value of Hunt's achievements. Rather, he proposes that Hunt's self-analysis and critical reflection become their own expressions of value. Hunt's imagination engaged how phenomena and ideas spread through media, through culture. His grappling with the worth of his own participation in these processes was useful. As Rosenblum concludes, the value that can be gleaned from the insights, questions, sparks of enlightenment, and significant challenges contained in Hunt's work is, in my opinion, beyond refute. If any of you listening weren't able to attend the Jerry Hunt exhibition here in Lubbock during February, I encourage you to seek out Jerry Hunt's work on your own. You can order the Transmissions from the Pleroma volume, or Stephen Housewright's memoir Partners, or Hunt's recordings through Blank Forms. I also point you to Michael Schell's online archive, jerryhunt.org. Finally, I'd also like to acknowledge the many people who assisted the Humanities Center in bringing Jerry Hunt's work to Texas Tech this year. Vice Provost Genevieve Durham DeCesaro, Joe Arredondo, Director of Landmark Arts in the School of Art, and his excellent staff, Hillary Aaron Russell, Courtney Jewin, Carly McMahon, and Patricia Jarrett. We're also indebted to Andy Gideon from the Texas Tech Museum and Maristella Feustel, archivist at the University of North Texas Music Library. And of course, to Lawrence Kumpf and Tyler Maxson from Blank Forms for curating the show. And that brings us to the end of another episode of Humanities Now. In our show notes, you'll find links to some of the material I referenced on this episode. My thanks to the Humanities Center staff, our media intern, Denise Marquez, the center's executive administrative assistant, Jacob Hall, and our new audio editor, Zion Khan. Thanks, as always, to Tyler Simpson for our original theme music. We'll be back soon with more conversations about what it means to be human. Be safe and be well.